We're going to go ahead and call the meeting to order. Welcome, everyone. This is just an informational hearing on two bills. And do we have a quorum?
Sure.
Seven a quorum or is it eight? We don't quite have a quorum yet, so we can't do the minutes from last time. We're going to do House File 1333 first, and that's my bill. I'm just going to just kind of do it from the chair and have testimony and move forward from that. And I see Callie is coming forward. I baked last night, so I brought cookies for committee members. And it's not quite Shamrock Shakes, but hopefully it'll do. Oh, you do? Oh, well, you shouldn't have told me that. Members, House File 1333 would allow the courts to consider termination or suspension of spousal maintenance if the receiving party is shown by the obligor to be cohabitating. In current law, there are three reasons that spousal support can be terminated or reconsidered: death of either the obligee or the obligor, remarriage of the obligee, and a substantial change in circumstances. Like so much of family law, spousal maintenance laws were largely written in the 1970s in an era where considerably less women worked outside of the home. I think it's prudent to take a fresh look at these laws, and House File 1333 is a first fresh look. This is by no means a perfect bill. In fact, if we were formally hearing this bill, I would offer some changes this morning. Actually, this afternoon, I guess it is now. This bill does, however, raise the issue of an obligee choosing to cohabitate rather than get married so that spousal support continues. Today, though, I would like us to have a thoughtful discussion on whether cohabitation on the part of the obligee should have any bearing on spousal support. House File 1333 sets out seven factors that the courts could consider in determining whether spousal support should be suspended or terminated based on the determination that the party receiving the support is cohabitating with someone. And I know that there probably is going to be some discussion here today of some court cases and some of the past history of this law. And I do have some one quote that I would like to read before we get started from the decision of Kelly Suzanne Thomas versus Michael Ray Thomas. Looks like this is an unpublished State of Minnesota Court of Appeals decision. And it says, in one of the comments on the opinion, it said, "Finally, we note that there is some expectation that respondent, at her young age and without dependent children, would strive to become self-supporting. It is troubling that she works only a few hours a week for marginal pay and expects to live off her substantial maintenance award while she is still relatively young. Even more troubling is that the respondent is in a serious long-term relationship with her significant other, including cohabitation. But we conclude that under the current state of law, and on this record, the district court did not abuse its discretion by denying appellate's motion to modify spousal maintenance obligation at this time." So it seems like in some cases, maybe the courts are saying that, you know, perhaps this should be a consideration, but because current law is what it is, we really can't take it into consideration. So with that, I would welcome testifiers to come forward. I don't have a list. I'm waiting to get a list of testifiers. Okay, and I believe Sue Wilson is the first person on that list. Yes, I made the cookies.
Let the record reflect those are great cookies.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let the record reflect that you got to own that a little bit more, Madam Chair. Okay.
I made the cookies. I said that Callie was bringing. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Have a seat. Thank and please you. Introduce yourself for the record. And yes, go ahead with your testimony.
My name is M. Sue Wilson. I am an attorney. I practiced for 40 years doing family law. I represented Michael Thomas in that case that you just cited. That's was a decision that was rendered last summer. And I've had several cases where there have been cohabitation issues, and we've gotten the same response from the Court of Appeals. So I want to say that I don't think this is a Republican or Democrat issue. I'm a avowed Democrat. I'm a feminist. I fought for spousal maintenance my whole career. What I see happening with all of the cases or many cases that were decided since the Nardini case, which allowed for permanent maintenance in Minnesota in long-term marriages, is that we've had women who were given permanent maintenance, some at a young age, such as Kelly Thomas, who received permanent maintenance at age 38. And they've gone on with their lives, and they will live with other people. But there's a tendency to not remarry because we've incentivized not remarrying. Remarriage means you lose the maintenance. There have been other decisions where the Court of Appeals has said things to the effect of the court in the Thomas case. Essentially, what we're left with is, while we have a body of case law that says if you can show that there is a financial benefit to the spouse receiving maintenance, if you can show that her need is reduced, then theoretically you could ask for and receive a modification of maintenance. But what ends up happening is that payee spouses have learned to game the system, and we have probably tens of thousands of people who would be married but for the state of our law. In other words, they have been divorced, they're receiving spousal maintenance, they're in relationships with people that are intimate, that are marriage-like relationships, they're living together, but they're not getting the wedding ring, because what that means is that they would lose the maintenance. So we are incentivizing exactly what we don't want to incentivize, which is cohabitation without marriage. I think there's a public policy in favor of marriage. And I've seen this happen over and over and over. I gave the assistant to this committee four briefs that I've written in the Court of Appeals and lost on great fact situations, you know, where we have people who have been together post-divorce with the person they're in a cohabiting relationship with for 10 or 15 years, who have exchanged rings but not been married, who are on each other's life insurance policies and have done all the estate planning, but will say, the reason I'm not married is because I lose the maintenance. And I think that it's a problem here. Other states, in one of the briefs we wrote, I did research. Other states have, around here, Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, have all dealt with this issue. And it's not, California has. I mean, there are statutes that say that if there is cohabitation, what that does, it just shifts the burden of proof over to the person cohabiting, saying, why shouldn't this mean a modification? Because there's going to be an economy of living together. I mean, people who live together don't have the same expenses as when they're living alone. And I just think to make spousal maintenance such a sacred cow that we can't modify our statute, even though you could kind of edge in under the current law by saying, okay, there is a benefit financially. But look at Kelly Thomas. I mean, she has a paramour who owns a really nice farm in southern Minnesota. They live there in the summer. She has a condo in Naples, which they call their house, in the winter. They live together all the time. And we can't modify maintenance, even though my client, and this was, I think, part of what was troubling, was Ms. Thomas had gone on Facebook, and there were lots of photos of her at various tropical locations with her paramour, you know, all winter. She was traveling and having a life that my client, who is a dentist and was working all the time, couldn't afford to do that, what she was doing. So there's an inherent unfairness. It strikes me as unfair as somebody who really values spousal maintenance. And I also think, just finally, that the mores have really shifted. That in 1975, when we adopted the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act in Minnesota, I don't think it was as common for people to live together outside of marriage, at least middle-aged people. You know, maybe the generation of young people at that point, but certainly not in people who were in their 40s and 50s. And now, it's not as frowned upon socially, and frankly, it's also financially beneficial. So there are people who are living together, and they're, as I said, it's a huge body of people who are not going to marry unless we do something. And I don't know that, you know, the definitions in this statute proposed are, these are just possible indicia of cohabitation and therefore economic benefit. There are other things in the Illinois statute. They just use the language, if the party receiving maintenance cohabits with another person on a continuing conjugal basis. In New York, the statute says the wife is habitually living with another man and holding herself out as his wife, although not married. In Iowa, the statute shifts the burden. If there is cohabitation, the burden shifts to the recipient to show why spousal support should continue in spite of the cohabitation because of an ongoing need. So it's not saying you lose all your maintenance once you cohabit. It's saying once you cohabit, the burden is shifting to you to show why you should continue to be supported by your ex-husband normally. I mean, most spousal maintenance is for women. And I think that's an appropriate analysis to do, because otherwise what you have, and I've seen this happens over and over, is that the ex-husband is supporting the new family. The ex-wife and her, I mean, how do you call him a boyfriend when in what, some of my cases they're in their 50s, but, you know, ex-wife and the man that she is going to live with until her maintenance ends without marriage. Once the maintenance ends, she would marry, because these people are in long-term committed relationships. So that's the problem with our law. The courts are reluctant to go there, and when they, I think they should have. And the Court of Appeals has said over and over, we don't have the legislative backup to do this. And I'm just asking that the legislature consider making cohabitation a grounds for modification, but not necessarily a rebuttable presumption. Simply, it's making it a rebuttable presumption and not an automatic loss. It could just mean a reduction. It could be a modification. It could lead to reservation, but it doesn't, it shouldn't be ignored.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. And I do have one question, because I know opponents will bring this up. In the language that we have before us, and this is probably one of the changes that I might make, but it talks about suspending the maintenance. And I guess I would like to see what your thoughts are on the fact that if you suspend it and then they're in and out of cohabitating relationships, are you going to have to go back to court every time? Would it be better just to say, you know, termination versus suspension? I just would wonder what your thoughts would be on that.
Well, you know, in family law, once you terminate spousal maintenance, you can never get it back.
Right.
And so we do in cases where, for example, the husband is in a dire straits at the time of the divorce, but in between jobs, we'll sometimes reserve it. And I think that in cases of, if it looks like the cohabitation is not, you know, it's 6 months old, maybe you would reserve it without terminating it. Because that way, if that relationship didn't last, then the wife could always come back and ask for more spousal maintenance from the ex-husband. But I think after a certain term, you know, when people are together for 10 years and testified, like in the Nelson case, it's another unpublished case, John Nelson in the Court of Appeals, where they're the ones who exchanged the wedding rings, and they were, you know, the children of the adult children of Mr. Nelson would be like the grandchildren of the new boyfriend. I think in those cases you should terminate. Because all you're doing is, you know, these people are going to get married. The only thing keeping them from getting married is the check they're getting every month. And we don't want that. I just don't think we want that in the state. I think it creates a kind of gaminess that really is undermining to the principle of maintenance for the women who really need it. And there are lots of them who are traditional homemakers in a 30-year marriage and have never worked outside the home and have a high school education. And they need maintenance. We don't want for them to lose maintenance because our statute has been so undermined by people who have treated it as a game and, you know, done, live their lives in a way that they'll keep getting the maintenance while they're still in another committed relationship.
Thank you. If you'd stand by, wait a second, we do have one question. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, one concern that I have about the bill as drafted has to do with the discovery and how intrusive that might be, and I guess I wanted to know if the testifier could just comment on that, you know, the idea that the obligor is going to be potentially having the right to find out about the bank accounts of the ex-spouse and exactly how living expenses are working, just various details like that. And I'm just curious, since you practice in this area, if you could comment on that, if the testifier could.
Ms. Wilson.
Yes, in any modification of maintenance, all of those things are up for grabs. And so we would normally, you know, try to find out the financial circumstances of the payee. And I don't, yes, that's intrusive, but which is the, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, I think the concern is that we're going to be doing telephoto lenses, you know, that we're going to be trying to prove that they're together. But in fact, you know, I had a case where in the actual decree, the parties had stipulated that maintenance would end on cohabitation, which is really hard to get anyone to agree to, but somebody did. And, you know, and I had to show that, in fact, they were having this their mail at the same address. I mean, that's a little intrusive, and that, you know, to show they were cohabiting. But I guess it's a balancing act. You know, if you're getting spousal maintenance, you're always going to have to show that you need it, that you don't, you haven't been able to replace it with a big inheritance, or you've won the lottery, or you've got a really good job. So if those things happen, you can always get all that financial information. I think the question is cohabiting, should it be one of those things like winning the lottery or getting a big inheritance? And many states have said yes. It is that important that would trigger the kind of discovery we do in modification motions.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Any other member questions for this testifier? Please stand by because something else may come up. Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Next, I have Steve Ballantyne. And while they're coming forward, we'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Vogel, would you like to move the minutes from March 26th?
Yes.
The minutes have been moved from March 26th. Any discussion? Seeing none, minutes. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved, and we're officially called to order. Thank you for being here this morning, and go ahead and state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Stephen Ballantyne, currently in West St. Paul, and I'm a payer of spousal maintenance. So I was actually excited to see this bill come up because I have done a lot of research in my own process of going through a divorce. Last year, I filed a modification due to my ex-wife begun a cohabitation relationship with her boyfriend. All of his furniture is there. His possessions, cars, even his children stay at that home when he has custody of them. Also, like I heard Ms. Wilson mention, the boyfriend actually receives his mail there, and they admitted that in court. However, my motion to or petition to modify the spousal maintenance was denied by the court because I couldn't prove that there was a financial benefit to my ex-wife. I mean, currently, the standard is requiring that there's some sort of benefit of him living there. Of course, we did receive all of the bank statements. We received that. There's nothing showing on that. My ex-wife claimed that he doesn't provide any expenses in the household and that the only thing he does pay for is her cell phone. So it's almost like she is able to support him living in the home, but I'm supporting their lifestyle because I'm the payer. Of course, you know, even today, as your bill would do, the obligation is on the obligor to prove that there's something. In this case, when I go to pick up my son every week, all of his vehicles are parked in the driveway. His furniture is in the garage. When I do walk into the house, his shoes, and he has very large shoes, are right there at the front of the house. So I'm still paying for their lifestyle, but they are truly living together. Actually, I appreciate, and I think it's paragraph 7 of this bill, where stating that the cohabitants don't necessarily have to live together. One of the arguments that in my case happened is my ex-wife's boyfriend is actually an over-the-road truck driver. So he's not necessarily in the house always during the week based on his job, but he is there on the weekends. All of his possessions are there. He has no other residence other than that home. So I am very much in favor of this bill. Absolutely, there can be some changes made. I think this follows what other states have enacted. I know right now in Florida, there's actually a major overhaul of all the spousal maintenance, and I know that's outside of this discussion now, but you know, I certainly hope that the committee would look at reviewing statute 518-552 for, you know, further more of a formula like what is currently in the child support area right now.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And is someone else here to testify as well?
My name is Christine Murphy. I was Mr. Ballantyne's attorney. I don't necessarily need to testify, but I do want to touch on the political aspect that has not been covered. This is not a partisan issue. It's not Democrat. It's not Republican. It's very simple. A woman and a man have both earning potential practically the same in Minnesota. There's no reason that after a contract is broken that one person should have to continue to support that other person. It flies in the face of every kind of legal argument you want to make. We as women can make our own money, we can make our own lives, we can make our own futures, but we have a law that simply says that we need someone else to support us. I don't think this law goes far enough. I really don't. But it does take a considerable step that would have made a huge difference in Mr. Ballantyne's case. His ex-wife was dating the man that she now lives with when they were getting a divorce. This is a long-term relationship, but they won't get married until his spousal maintenance expires, until someone else can take care of her legally. So I applaud your efforts, Chairwoman Scott. This is a great step, and I know it's not supported by the bar, but it's an excellent step in the right direction. 1975 laws for spousal maintenance and matrimonial laws are no longer, they're not appropriate anymore in 2015.
Thank you for your testimony. I do have some data here that staff got for me that says in 2013, 25 through 34-year-old women were 21% more likely than men to be college graduates and 48% more likely to have completed graduate school. And women now account for almost half of the JD, MBA, and MD programs, up from less than 10% in the 1960s. So times are changing, folks, and I appreciate your testimony and your bringing that topic up. Thank you. Are there any questions for either one of these testifiers? Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michael Ditbrenner is next. There he is. Welcome back to the committee. I think you know the drill. Go ahead and state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Certainly. My name is Michael D. Ditbrenner, and I'm the legislative chair of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers Minnesota chapter. I'm speaking on behalf of them. I've also been asked to speak on behalf of the family law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. Both organizations took unanimous votes opposing the cohabitation bill. I've left a one-page handout back there, which everybody may have, which talks about the current law and impact of spousal maintenance recipients' cohabitation with receipt of gifts from another adult. The operative statute is 518A.39 subdivision 2A, which provides that a party seeking to reduce spousal maintenance may prevail by proving that the maintenance award is unreasonable and unfair due to the maintenance recipient's substantially increased income or substantially decreased need. And indeed, it's that which leads courts to modify, reduce, or eliminate spousal maintenance due to cohabitation. I've also cited case law from the Minnesota Supreme Court from the 1970s, which basically states that to the extent that cohabitation creates an economic benefit to the cohabitee, to the cohabitant that's receiving spousal maintenance, that the court is therefore empowered to reduce or modify or eliminate the spousal maintenance to the extent that the award is unreasonable and unfair. Why might a court not modify spousal maintenance even though somebody is cohabitating? Well, one reason may be whether or not the award was issued after a trial, a contested case, or whether the award was stipulated to. If it's contested case, then they're more apt to modify. If it's a stipulation, then they're less apt to modify. Also, is the obligor able to pay the spousal maintenance as ordered? Is he got a huge surplus of income over his expenses or her expenses? In that case, the court may be less apt to find that the award is unreasonable and unfair despite the cohabitation. Also, the person receiving the spousal maintenance, what is their level of expenses? If their expenses are such that even with the cohabitation that they're not able to meet or they're just barely meeting their expenses, then again, the court may be less apt to reduce the spousal maintenance. And that's basically one of the reasons why we don't support legislation that would suspend or terminate maintenance merely due to somebody's cohabitation. We believe that the law is stable, well settled, has done a good job, has stood the test of time. I should also note, too, there are concerns genuinely about harassment, about cohabitation. And the problems with cohabitation statutes are, on the one end, are they so general that they sweep up people into their ambit who are not even cohabitating due to a romantic relationship, such as the parent that has an adult child that moves back into the family home, the parent that's just, you know, residing with a platonic friend, the parent who has somebody else, like a elderly parent of their own, who moves back into the house. Then when you go in the other direction, which you have statutes that would terminate based upon cohabitation with a romantic partner, that's when you get into the risk of the harassment, because there becomes this big, shiny object that somebody's trying to prove, which is that they've got this meritorious relationship that they're involved in, and we're going to drill down and try to find out whether or not they're sleeping with this person. And, you know, family law attorneys are good advocates. They can do a lot of help, and they can also do a lot of damage, as can private investigators. And so the risk always becomes, do you create a bright, shiny object with a cohabitation statute and then encourage these attorneys to go into litigation overdrive with motions to modify or terminate support because based upon that cohabitation? And that's always the risk that you run. And I think that's the risk by creating the bright, shiny object that you would have in this bill. And there's many reasons that people cohabit. You know, sometimes it's just they're not making it on the maintenance that's been provided. They're trying to share expenses with somebody. It doesn't need to be a romantic partner. So the risk is that you sweep all these different people into that type of situation. So I also wanted to add that we had a retreat recently, the Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, last year, on the issue of our spousal maintenance laws. Do we need to relook at them? How are they working for us? And the vast majority of people that attended this conference, included therapists, judges, accountants, attorneys, so on and so forth, came to the conclusion that our spousal maintenance statutes actually work fairly well. And these are people that represent both sides of the equation, men, women, spousal maintenance recipients, spousal maintenance obligors. And then, of all the people that thought there should be some changes made, not a single one suggested that there was a problem with the cohabitation law that was at this retreat. So this is really something that doesn't stir a lot of burning passions among people that practice in this area, that something needs to be done about it because we have people that are doing something bad and they're getting away with it. You know, the viewpoint of the people that practice in there, primarily, you know, some attorneys, such as Ms. Wilson, accepting, is that the law works. People are able to use the court system efficiently and wisely without it going overboard and actually harming and hurting people. So That's all I'll have. I'll take any questions that anybody on the committee might have for me.
Well, I'll just be the devil's advocate here. I'm hearing you say some of the same things that were said before we talked about the child custody issues. And sometimes I think that when you're in the thick of it, this is what you do for your job and those sorts of things, sometimes you don't see always what's going on from an outside perspective. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring this. So even though, you know, maybe people that in the matrimonial section or the Minnesota matrimonial attorneys or the family law section, maybe they're not seeing, they don't see a need for change. That doesn't necessarily mean that the public doesn't see that need for change. And I think this is a fairness issue. Certainly it ought to be a consideration. I know this bill isn't perfect, but I do like some of Illinois' language in it, and it has in there that that they would have to have a continuing conjugal, you know, relationship. And I know proving that is another thing, but I think the gentleman that testified here, I mean, it couldn't be any plainer than the nose on my face what's going on there. And I mean, I don't know his ex-wife's financial situation. If the maintenance was to be removed, would that create a hardship? But certainly she has someone else living with her, making an income, and I'm guessing that he's sharing in the expenses. So anyway, any other questions for this testifier? All right, seeing none, thank you so much, Mr. Dibbern. Okay. I just wanted to bring members' attention to, there is some written testimony from Nicole N. Middendorf, and who is a financial advisor. And so I would just bring that to the attention of members to please read through that as well. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Thank you. Please come forward. Go ahead and state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee members. My name is Mike Downing. The reason I would like to talk about this bill is philosophically I would support this bill. But in any rule, there should be exceptions. And the reason I'm here is I'm representing a 40-year-old daughter of my wife's and mine. Our daughter was verbally abused, financially abused, emotionally abused, and yes, physically abused. Abused women are still victims after a divorce. And we need to be aware of these victims of abuse. And there needs to be some protection of these women after the marriage is over because the abuse and harassment continues. So I would ask the committee members to look into exceptions. And that would be to somehow protect women that have been abused, because it takes a long, long time to recover from that abuse. Secondly, our daughter has three special needs children. She was a stay-at-home mom. She has one child that inherited her ex-husband's ADHD. She has one child that inherited her ex-husband's ADHD and ODD, oppositional defiance disorder, and one child that has seizures. With these special needs, she needs to be around the children to provide the maternal support to these special needs children. So even though our daughter's spousal support was only for 1 year, and this doesn't really apply to her, there are probably other women that are in special needs children, and there need to be protections and ways to protect women that have been either abused or have special needs children that need some help. They can't all be attorneys. They all can't be doctors or dentists or engineers. They go into professions that gives them the flexibility to provide the maternal support that children with special needs need. But that's all I have to say, but thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Downey. And for sure, we would want to make sure that if this was going to be a detriment to the kids or their situation, that would be taken into consideration. Thank you. Representative Lesh.
I have maybe a question for Mr. Gehring or Ms. Mullen, Madam Chair. I'm not a family lawyer, but my understanding that the determination of based on need is all calculated through child support, and none of that is considered for the purposes of spousal maintenance, the subject of this bill. Am I wrong about that? Is what the last testifier talked about subject matter for child support award, or does it all impact spousal maintenance?
Ms. Mullen?
Chair and representatives, you can have an award of both child support and spousal maintenance, and that's common to have. The special needs of the children could be taken into consideration for both of those awards in calculating those.
Does that answer your question? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Thank you so much for indulging our conversation and for the testifiers making the effort to be here today. I really appreciate it. And with that, we will go to our next bill, also an informational hearing on House File 1348. That's Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have several testifiers with me.
You bet. Go ahead.
They could come forward.
Could you share with us the premise of your bill?
Thank you. Madam Chair, House File 1348 is what has been characterized as the greatest sea change in dissolution law since we went to no-fault divorce over a generation ago. Now, normally, you don't start out presenting your bill like that, saying this is a major change, because you don't want your bill to be controversial, you want it to pass. Unless you are actually coming up here to do your job as a legislator, which is to affect change, in which case you have to start out with a conversation, so which is why we appreciate your offer of an informational hearing, Madam Chair. I know that you're not necessarily favorably inclined toward the bill, but the conversation is where all the subject matter starts. So, Madam Chair, you and other members of the committee know that there have been many complaints about the divorce system in Minnesota, and the complaints suggest that we need a better alternative. Now, as members of the legislature, we could say, well, of course, you go to court and you're not going to be satisfied. As I often hear judges say, the only people who ever want to be in the courthouse is if you go there for a wedding or for an adoption. Other than that, nobody wants to be there. It's because of a bad situation, the result of two couples who are married deciding that the relationship has broken down, which is a very sad experience for almost everyone I know who's gone through it, including myself. But the system we have set up now is that it encourages an adversarial approach. Now, it's possible that if you get everyone involved, the right people, that it doesn't have to be adversarial, even under the current system. Under the current system, it is possible to go through cooperatively, reach an agreement, and come out on the other end where people aren't really happy, but they're satisfied, and they can move forward with their lives, raising their children, and even getting along with their former spouse in a healthy way, that's still important. Even if you don't have children, there are still reasons from time to time to be in touch with your former spouse for one reason or another. And it'd be helpful if you didn't have to constantly get over bad blood from that. This adversarial approach was evident in my situation over 10 years ago when I got divorced. And my wife and I agreed that we wanted both to participate fully, 50%, in the raising of our child, Alice, who you've seen around here, who's now 14 and is going to Central High School next year, by the way. Go Minutemen. They're the Minutemen over there.
That's where my kids are, too.
Greg Davids want to know who the mascot is, and they're the Minutemen. Interesting story behind the mascot, but I'll leave that aside. Point being, we decided that we were going to participate jointly. I also knew that Tina, my ex, was very concerned about losing her time with our child, and she thought that maybe I might try to get more time, and I said, no, let's agree on it. I'll agree to 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Saturdays, and I wasn't satisfied with that, but Tina's happiness going forward was really important to me, too, because she was the chief female role model for my daughter, and I wanted to make sure there wasn't any lingering bad blood. So we agreed on all the terms. And I did a bad job of trying to put together a complaint, because I didn't understand family law. And I said, you know, this is going to be adequate. I know. Why don't you go hire an attorney? We'll both participate 50% in the cost for the attorney, memorialize the agreement, and then put it through, and we'll see how long it takes. Now, mind you, we were both in very, very bad situations at this point. It was very emotional, and it was tough to do, but we were able to get past that. I still remember going through, divvying up the stuff, making the decision about who got what. Tina did a lot of the work in that because I was zoned out. I wasn't even able to deal. So I appreciated her work in doing that and recognize it. And the next thing I know, about 3 weeks later, I got a letter through in the mail telling me that I would get to see my daughter 2 weekends a month, and then I would have to pay $1,500 a month in child support. And on down the line, what the letter was, I refer to as it a Scud missile. All of a sudden, out of the blue, it showed up. And so what did I immediately do? I immediately called Tina, and I said, what happened? And she said, well, the attorney, you know, told me that you're a lawyer and you know how this stuff works, that I don't, you're trying to take advantage of me, and you just don't want to pay any child support. And I said, we agreed that we were going to pay 50-50. She's like, I know, but you know all this stuff, and she told me things that you didn't tell me. Well, I didn't know, and I was surprised. So, of course, then I had to lawyer up also. And what occurred is, over the course of the next year, is a lot of costs and fees, briefs back and forth. And over the course of that time, effort and energy, which caused a lot of consternation, because during this period at the same time, we were trying to decide how we were going to jointly raise our child. And this tension did not make it any easier. These are pivotal months when you decide how the rest of your life is going to go, if you want to be involved in the life of your child, and you want to maintain, if at all possible, a good relationship with your ex. And so it ended up costing her a lot more money, and ended up costing me more money, and it didn't serve us very well at all. But ultimately afterwards, I prevailed on Tina and said, you know what, do you really want to go this different route because we can, or do you want to get us back to that point where we agreed originally? Do you agree with it or not? She said, well, yeah, I mean, I do. I think the agreement we came up with was a pretty good one. And I said, okay, well, let's do that then. So ultimately, that's what we got. We got pretty much the original agreement that we came up with. But after months of arguing between our lawyers and thousands upon thousands of dollars of costs that we otherwise wouldn't have incurred, we arrived back at the same spot. And that is because the system is designed to be adversarial. You make a motion, somebody responds. If they don't respond, there's always the lingering threat of a judge coming in to weigh in. And I thought to myself, you know, we reached this agreement at our home. Why can't people be respected and trusted enough to reach an agreement in the same way that they reached the agreement to get married themselves? When Tina and I were in our third year of law school, we were living in an apartment down off of Marshall and Western by the Boy Scouts down there, Cathedral Hill. And we bought a house up in the South Como neighborhood. But our lease, the duration of our lease went on for another 3 months. So we went to our landlord and we said, I know our lease goes on longer, but we want out of the lease because we bought a house. And he said, well, no, you can't have out of the lease. And I said, well, what is it going to take? What do you need to be on lease? He's like, well, with an extra $500, I'll let you out of the lease. I was like, oh, for crying out loud. Fine. Okay, we paid him $500 to get out of the lease. Nobody suggested we had to hire attorneys to break that agreement. Nobody suggested we had to go to court and make motions and put it in front of someone else to determine whether or not someone was being taken advantage of. We were trusted to make decisions for our own benefit as adults, as legally consenting adults, to ensure we had the capacity, we had the ability to govern our own lives. So the larger purpose of this bill is to change the culture of divorce from a contested legal proceeding to a family transition that can be done thoughtfully and with goodwill. It's likely that the private market will create a number of supportive services, from divorce counseling to divorce planning, to templates for agreements that will continually make the process easier to use. I firmly believe that that is the direction that we are moving, I hope that, albeit not this year, that this idea gets further progress in subsequent legislative sessions. And I have with me former Representative Andy Dawkins, with whom I interned in 1997, so he got me started here. If anyone wants to blame anyone for my presence here, he's sitting right next to me.
You were a great intern, Ken.
Go ahead, Mr. Dawkins.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, Andy Dawkins, and it's an honor to be back here. I miss all of you, though. I think there's not a one on this committee right now that was on the committee when I had the chair many years ago. But I like being back because I really miss the institution. So I appreciate you hearing the bill for information purposes today. I was a family law attorney for 35 years. I was in the legislature for 15 years. I was the chief author of the parenting plans law that we enacted. I had 6 years experience as a child support magistrate in Hennepin County after I left the legislature. About 2 years ago, Erickson Mediation Institute convened about 70 of us for the purpose of trying to figure out how can we get the adversarialness out of our divorce law. And in the end, about 20 of us met as a core group twice a month for the past 2 years, and we came up with this bill. Our members, actually, of the core group were more female than male. We have a judge who's on the bench today and can't be here. We have a professor from the University of Minnesota, who, Bill Doherty, who heads the families on the brink, trying to preserve marriages as opposed to having people divorce. We had family therapists, child therapists, and marriage therapists. We had mediators. We had a good group that met, and we were meeting because the current system has adversarialness baked into it. It promotes conflict. It encourages couples to become opponents in a win-lose high-stakes contest, and often poisons the well for future cooperation. Even when there's a stipulated settlement, an agreement at the end of it, that long shadow of what will the judge say about it, it covers those negotiations. You hear, the judge won't agree with you. Or in a situation where someone is advised, if you deal with your chemical dependency, maybe we can move forward in this. And the lawyer says, no, you go to a chemical dependency counselor right now, that shoots the heck out of any chance that you have in those kids later. So it's all this being a lawyer to the maximum ability to defend your client that causes unavoidably the tensions of, boy, we both need to really get to our respective corners and fight this thing out. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to have baked-in adversarialness. It doesn't have to have baked-in emotional distress. It doesn't have to have baked-in expense. The bill's easy to explain, tricky to draft, and puts in motion a great philosophical debate. So let me take each of those things one at a time. For easy to explain, the bill says there's no judge involved in your divorce case. It's not necessary to have a judge when you have two people who are not in battle. It's an alternative. It's voluntary. It's not for every case. You go and get a computer password, get into the computer system, do an intent to divorce form, you read the instructions and the warnings, you do your own agreements about how you want your next part of your life to look like. You fill the forms out and submit a declaration of divorce. If you need to get a mediator to help you get there, if you need to get a lawyer to help you get there, if you need to get a family counselor to help you get there, all those resources are out there, and I think there's going to be a growing industry to help people get to this cooperative divorce that I foresee as being what more people will want to do than not. You wait 90 days, then you get a certificate of divorce. That certificate is a private agreement. It's not public. It's encrypted in our system, in the computer system, so that it can't be unilaterally altered by one person. You get a certificate that's public that just says you're a divorced person. That's at the Vital Statistics Department. You can modify your agreement by a subsequent agreement. It's flexible that way. You can, because you've shown cooperation, you can cooperatively move forward. That if your things change, if your kids grow older and you can see there needs to be a difference, you can do that without having to go to court as well. Or you can go to court to modify it. And then you cross the line into our court system. So there's the private track we're talking about, and then there's the court system track. And if you need to enforce the contract that you made to dissolve your marriage, you can go to court to enforce that contract using our existing law. I think, though, the important part is that when you have voluntary agreements, it's much more likely that people will want to follow what they voluntarily agreed to. Now, I said it's tricky to draft, and that's why I really appreciate you having the information hearing today. Let's make sure we get a good checklist. What are the concerns that lawyers have or others have about how the bill is drafted? And then we'll do some good work over the summer and over the fall to do the kind of amendments to make this thing work. What it sets in motion, though, the reason that I'm so excited about being here today is that I think it's really going to be a great debate this committee is going to have, hopefully for taking a vote on this at some point.
Go ahead, Mr. Dock.
The debate will, I think, end up being framed like this. On the one side, getting the government out of people's private lives, about letting families decide what's best for themselves, about how there will be healthier families and healthier children who get the role model off a cooperative parenting agreement, whether there'll be less animosity, less violence, versus on the other side of the debate, weighing the scales on which one's going to come in and which are we going to see happen if we do this. Will there be increased divorces because it's too easy? Will there be mistakes made by these parties who did it on their own that need to be corrected? Will there be more coerced agreements with one domineering spouse taking advantage of the other? I think there are very strong arguments that militate against all three of those things, that there will not be more divorces made easier, that there won't be more coerced and bullied agreements, and there won't be the mistakes made that aren't correctable. What I don't want the debate to be in this committee is about the technical drafting concerns. I agree that there's some, just like in the bill that you presented earlier, Madam Chair, there's going to have to be some really strong drafting done to make sure we take care of it the right way. And I also don't want the debate in this committee to be about the constitutionality of our proposal. There's nothing in the United States or Minnesota Constitution that requires divorces be in court. If this legislature decided to assign a court function to the executive branch, if we tried to give some court powers to the executive branch, like when we set up an administrative child support system that was in the executive branch, then yes, the Minnesota Supreme Court would step in and say there's been blurring of the separation of powers. You're trying to give a court function to the executive branch when we say we can do this outside the court system. But we don't have that situation here. Unlike those kind of cases, there's no case or controversy. There's two people that are in an agreement. So there's no need to have a judicial resolution of it. So there's no original case that has to be in court. I believe we have a solid constitutional basis to go forward with this. We'll have to do the really good, and Ms. Mullen and others can help us, but we're going to have to make sure that there's an integration of the two systems, because there will be crossover points. For example, if you do your own private agreement that divides up a pension, you're going to have to get the court administration to sign off on that to make it an order, or the federal IRS won't allow it. There are things like that that need to get drafted, and we can do it. Those kind of technical concerns, I'm confident we can deal with. The debate in the end should be focused on, if enacted, will this result in less animosity, less violence, more cooperation, and healthier families? Or would such great results be outweighed by concerns as to the increase in divorces, mistakes being made, or coerced agreements. If asked, I can tell you why I don't believe that that would be the case in either one of those three situations. Before I take any questions, I want to conclude by saying that as a legislator, it took 4 years to pass the parenting plans law. And we heard from the Bar Association and we heard from the judges that the sky will fall if Dawkins' parenting plans gets enacted. Now it's universally acclaimed as a great advance in family law. When I was on the bench over in Hennepin County as magistrate, the judges, the very judges were pounding at the table here saying, that's a terrible idea Dawkins has. Came up to me and said, you know, you had a good idea, and it works out pretty well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this specific testifier? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, as I look through here, I'm not sure who is intervening on the children's behalf as far as representation. And I can see where the two adults will be able to talk and discuss and provide for maybe a deal that works out for the best of them. And I'm not suggesting that it's not a good idea, but my thought would be that in a regular divorce situation, you would have a judge or somebody that would probably be charged with intervening on the children's behalf. Where does that enter into it so that their interests are probably independently represented relative to the two people seeking the divorce?
Mr. Dawkins?
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, in our current system, there's no way that those children have their individual representative unless that there's a special need, special reason. I think that if that special reason or special need is there, you should probably go to the existing court system for that divorce as opposed to bringing it through this way. But my premise is that we really need to have a cultural change in the way we have our mindset about all this, that the paternalistic outlook that only judges know best as opposed to what the two parents know what's best for their family. And I really believe that the kids that grow up in a divorce that was a black divorce and see their parents modeling that are going to be better off than the kids that grow up in an adversarial one. But no, there's the children's interests are represented by the parents. That's our current system.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I wasn't suggesting that a judge would be in a better position. It's just that sometimes when you get into matters such as lists, it's good to have kind of a third party espousing for people that can't really espouse for themselves. So it wasn't a criticism of the concept itself. It was more or less, and fortunately I've not gone through the process, so I don't know exactly how it works, but just the concept of having somebody looking specifically at the interest of those children opposed to the two parties that are trying to craft an agreement that, yes, works for the two of them, but could miss something relative to the children themselves.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, when I went through my divorce 10 years ago, it was under the current system as we have it, and we didn't have a guardian ad litem. There was no reason that the court could see that someone would have to oversee it. And I would also add that I think that that really would have fundamentally changed my perspective and respect for the ultimate agreement. If I had someone weighing in, deciding that they thought was best for my child better than I did, I would have bristled at that absolutely. When we reached our agreement and my ex-wife and I reached our cooperative parenting plan, and we had still, because of that, despite the current system, but because of our persistence 10 years ago, we agreed on it together. We continue to have a good relationship. She is one of my closest friends. I got married 2.5 years ago. She did a reading at my wedding. We're as close, I think, as two exes can be. In fact, I still consider her family and her husband. She got married, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. We don't hang out weekends together, you know, but I mean it's really important to me. But the fact is that my respect for the agreement of how we jointly raise our child, because we reached it cooperatively as parents for our kid, is much more increased because we reached that. In fact, you know, I have my daughter 2 days a week. I want to have her more now. And she's 14, she's really interesting, and I'd like to have her around a lot more. And my ex-wife knows that, but I'm
very hesitant to even broach the subject because I know that my ex is very sensitive about that, and I respect her, and I respect the agreement that we reached. When you have a decree that's foisted upon you, I think that dynamic is altered substantially. So, well, it wasn't reached by us. I don't have as much of a stake in it. It was thrust upon me, and I'm going to challenge it. And I guarantee you, if I challenged it, my ex would be pretty upset, and I really don't want to upset her. So I think it matters quite a bit that parents have the say, the primary say.
Mr. Dawkins?
Madam Chair and Representative Vogel, maybe two more things about it quickly. One is that under our current system as well, before there's a divorce, before there's a court action, the parents do get to make the decision. So even if a mom is saying, you know, I'm going to do all this with the kids, and the dad is saying, no, I don't want you to, and a judge, if the judge were looking in on it, would say, hey, dad's right, mom's wrong. We don't have that now. And so I really think that it's a good concern, but judges that look at divorce cases are looking out for children and child support and other things like that, but I don't think we're wanting them to weigh in on the parenting decisions. The other thing, the second thing is that Australia is the only Western world country or state that has tried to go in this direction that Representative Lesh and with maybe perhaps other people's support we can get to here in Minnesota. But Australia just did half the loaf. Australia says that parents know best about the parenting, so that parents in Australia can do their entire own agreement without a judge weighing in on it as to the parenting part. But for finances, dividing up their pensions or their property, you still have to get the judge to countersign on what your agreement is. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Dawkins. We do have a few people here, Michael Ditburner, and on deck is Brian Lake with the Minnesota Bar Association. It's a two for today, Mr. Ditburner. Please state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Sure. My name is Michael D. Ditburner. I'm appearing on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimony and Lawyers. I'm their legislative chair. Probably doesn't come as a surprise that we don't support this legislation either. But I do want to get to the issue, first of all, of the need for the legislation. And I've got a one-page handout that's at the back. It's called Current Law Court Rules, Simplified Divorce With or Without Going to Court. And I want to assure everybody that you don't need to have a lawyer to get divorced. There's nothing in our laws that require people to have lawyers in order to be able to get divorced. In fact, since the 1980s, there has been an explosion of situations in which neither party have an attorney representing them, and they're somehow able to enter into divorce agreements and get those divorce agreements approved by judges. It used to be that you had to have a hearing before a judge would approve your divorce stipulation. That was changed by a statute that was enacted in 1991 called 518.13 subdivision 5. And what that provides is that assuming that neither party has children and both parties have attorneys representing them, they can go to a hearing have their divorce decrees approved without a hearing. The only time in which they have to have a hearing is if they have children and one of the parties doesn't have an attorney. But, you know, that's an easy thing to overcome. I mean, if they can enter, they can go to a hearing if they have a stipulation and get that stipulation approved by the court. There's also a streamlined process where people can bypass a hearing altogether if they've been married for less than 8 years and have no assets, no kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's also a lot of programs that offer people a way of getting divorced without having lawyers, such as the different computer programs that are out there. There's WeVorce, there's I Can Divorce. There are programs in Hennepin County whereby attorneys volunteer free of charge to represent people at different settlement conferences that are otherwise unrepresented by counsel to help them get through a divorce proceeding. So you don't really need to have an attorney at all if you want to get divorced in this day and age. And there are things that are out there for people to easily get divorced and get divorced rather quickly. Under this legislation, you'd have to wait 60 days after doing a notice of intent to get a divorce in order to get divorced. Under this day and age, with e-filing and e-service, you can get divorced pretty immediately. In fact, you can even do a joint petition for a divorce if you want to. But it is true that when there's kids involved, we take a little bit more serious look at that and we try to figure out those things. I heard Representative Dawkins refer to Australia. I did want to note that there are services that the country of Australia provides to people that are going through those custody cases. It is a social democracy, a.k.a. socialist country, unlike our country, which it doesn't have those types of services that we provide to people. Also, the notion that somehow the current process makes things adversarial. All those different people that are getting divorced without lawyers or even with lawyers that are able to settle their cases, it's probably in excess of 95% of the cases that don't go to a court trial. So there are a lot of people every day, all the time, who are going through amicable divorces without having to be nasty. I did hear, though, and I've heard this from some of the proponents of the legislation, that the knowledge that there might be a judge out there who might not approve of an agreement or might have a different point of view than one of the parties somehow causes people to be adversarial. And I'm really struggling with that notion. I don't understand what it is about a knowledge of a judge being out there to possibly decide a case might make it adversarial. Well, for one thing, people aren't going to use this new process anyway if one of them doesn't want to do it, so they'll be going to court anyway and having a judge decide that case. But judges are there. They're sort of a backstop for us in situations. They don't use this power often, but in the case where there's an agreement presented to them that is really swayed to one side and is rather inequitable, then they may step in and say, you know, there's something that troubles me about this case. Maybe it's some kind of provision of the agreement that doesn't seem to be rather fair. Maybe it's just the knowledge that one of the parties is has been a victim of domestic abuse. Maybe it's their knowledge they're in a county where the parties might have appeared in front of them in juvenile court, and they're not sure that the agreement is fair for the kids. Maybe it's a long-term marriage with a dependent spouse where there's no spousal maintenance award, and one of the parties who has income and money is being awarded the house and seemingly all of the assets. In those types of cases, the court might ask the parties to come in for a hearing to discuss their agreement to try to make sure whether it's fair or not. And I recently saw the movie American Sniper, and I remember the reference that one of the characters in that movie made that was fairly apt, that there's three kinds of people. There's the sheep, there are the wolves, and then there's the sheepdogs. And the sheepdogs protect the sheep from the wolves. And that's sort of like analogous to what a judge does when presented with an inequitable agreement that people might enter into. They don't do it very often. It doesn't happen that often at all. But they are there to try to protect against inequity. I want to quote what Justice Yetka said in 1989 in the Karen versus Karen decision. And I think this holds true today. This is the Minnesota Supreme Court. The trial court stands in place and on behalf of the citizens of the state as a third party to dissolution actions. It has a duty to protect the interests of both parties and all the citizens of the state to ensure that the stipulation is fair and reasonable to all. If this legislation were to pass, then you wouldn't have that prospect of a judge reviewing the stipulation to see whether it's fair and equitable. And that's the basic problem with the legislation as I see it. I mean, lack of judicial supervision is not a bug in this legislation. It's a feature because they truly believe that just having a judge there to potentially review an agreement creates people into adversaries that are going to, you know, combat each other. And, you know, that's a view of judges in the judicial process that I certainly don't share, and I don't think many people share at all. I think judges are there to do justice. And in some cases, we need to have them take a look at agreements to make sure that they're fair and equitable, to make sure that children are not placed in a difficult position by their parents, or to prevent other people from being taken advantage of. I've seen cases where a father who was involved in their children's lives, where the proposal was that that person has no legal custody rights whatsoever. I have seen situations where there was an insistence that a father who posed no threat or harm to his children, the other person was insisting that somehow their parenting time must be supervised. And so there is unfairness that occurs all the time. There's the extreme of domestic violence cases that unfortunately happen far too often in our society. Suggest maybe a wife is taking advantage of their husband's infidelity and now is insisting on a really unfair agreement that shuts them out of their children's lives and forces them to hand over non-marital assets. And so in those types of situations, I say hooray for judges. It's a good thing that we have them there to protect against inequitable agreements. And why we would somehow think that that poisons the well and creates problems for people, I do not understand. I also want to point out, too, that it's useful having a court system in place when people are going through these agreements, because sometimes people make mistakes. The most common mistake that I see is legal descriptions to property, to real estate, that can negatively impact on people's ability to transfer title. A lot of people sometimes think that the property tax assessment legal description is an accurate legal description. It's very often not. And if you have that in some kind of legal document, it's nice to be able to have the judge there to amend a divorce decree to put the correct legal description in. And that's something that you would lose with this. Also, qualified domestic relations orders. That's the only way that you can divide retirement assets. If you have this thing, people will eventually have to go start a court proceeding anyway to get a qualified domestic relations order approved that divides assets, because that's a federal law. That's not a state law. And finally, I respectfully disagree with Representative Dawkins. I think it's really important to look at the constitutionality of this. And the case that's directly on point is a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1997 called Holmberg versus Holmberg. That's 588 Northwest 2nd, 720, 1999. In that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court unanimously overturned Minnesota's child support administrative law judge system. And the reason that they did that was because there was inadequate judicial supervision of child support administrative law judges, ALJs as we know them, decisions. All you had was a right of appeal to the Court of Appeals if you didn't like an ALJ's decision in a child support case. And because of that lack of judicial supervision, the Minnesota Supreme Court invalidated that statute. And it's right there for everybody to see. Now, I've heard some people suggest that, well, there's no case or controversy. How would it ever come to be that one of these agreements would get invalidated? You know, nobody was going to go running to the court to invalidate the statute right at the beginning of the case because both parties are entering agreement. Actually, the place where it will be validated was when somebody tries to enforce one of these divorce agreements in the divorce without courts or the private cooperative divorce process. That's when somebody will say, hey, I shouldn't be obligated to follow this agreement because this is unconstitutional. The legislature has delegated judicial authority to the executive branch, to the Bureau of Mediation Services. And that, at that point, then you'll have the invalidation. And you'll have all these people, you know, that will be sort of out of luck, that will think that they have entered into agreements that were valid and stood the test of time, only to find out that a judge has decided they're unconstitutional. And I don't think you want those constituents with the phones ringing off the hook by passing a law like this only to find. I mean, this language in the Holmberg case, read it. It's really on point. I mean, it's as clear and present a warning of this unconstitutionality of delegating judicial authority as you could possibly get. I mean, there is just no hope for this legislation surpassing constitutional muster.
There just isn't. The language is far too direct in that opinion. And I don't. And the problem that you have in this situation is that there is no judicial supervision of these private divorce agreements that would be housed in the Bureau of Mediation Services. It's expected and wanted and desired that these agreements are binding on people. And because of that lack of judicial supervision, that makes the delegation unconstitutional, and it really has no chance. And I think that you really shouldn't be passing unconstitutional statutes that could literally result in thousands of divorce agreements becoming invalidated. That's going to hurt people. That's going to injure people. That's not going to help people. I have nothing further unless there's anybody that wants to ask questions.
Any questions for this testifier? All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Representative Lesh, do you have any comments in between while we're waiting for Mr. Lake to make his way forward?
Well, maybe I shouldn't, Madam Chair, but maybe I shouldn't has never really been my path. So, but what you just heard can best be described as bluster. I don't even know where to start. First of all, the suggestion, offered as evidence for the fact that you can already get a divorce with no problem, the 95% of dissolutions don't go to trial, as evidence for the fact that these dissolutions are amicable, is silly. My divorce didn't go to trial. And it was harrowing, it was difficult, it was emotional, it was expensive, and it didn't go to trial. I fall into Mr. Ditburner's happy 95%, and it was not happy. The attorney that my ex-wife went to, Valerie Arnold, I still remember her name, I will never forget her name. She implicated dishonesty on my part. She implicated my only desire to spend time with my child predicated on pecuniary gain. She suggested that I would aim to deprive Tina of her parenting time as a mother with my child. It nearly destroyed my ability to have any semblance of a decent family life in the wake of what already was a difficult time. And Mr. Ditburner suggested, no, this worked out just perfect for me, like it works out for everyone. That's silly. As for the constitutional argument, it's really evidence for the fact that the industry, the divorce industry, not criticizing any individual member of it individually, but really has blinders on how this all has to work. No, it has to go in front of a judge. Keep aside from the fact that I'm kind of offended by Mr. Ditburner's likening the divorce of the process of divorce to going to war. There may be some similarities, and the judge is the sheepdog. If the judge is the sheepdog, then the litigants are the wolves. Members and Madam Chair, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. So we need to get past this backward thinking, because this backward thinking hurts people. It hurt people like me 10 years ago, and I never said anything about it. 10 years ago, when we went through the income shares debate, it was big, and everyone, just like Representative Dawkins said, that it was going to be horrible afterwards. No, it's not horrible afterwards. There was all kinds of suggestions that things would happen that didn't pan out. So I am fine with reasonable criticism of this proposal, because it is a sea change in how we do things. But it has to be reasonable. No one has suggested that the situation I talked about with my landlord, where we broke the lease, was unconstitutional and wouldn't be recognized, and I'd have to worry about that. No one suggested that. You have as much of an ability to come to an agreement with your ex as you do in any other situation where you have a dispute. And suggesting that it has to go before a judge and you have to hire attorneys I still believe to this day that Valerie Arnold owes my ex-wife about a $10,000 refund because we ended up with the same result at the end that we came with in the front, but she bilked her for a lot of money that she paid that she didn't get value for. So clearly, I'm a little probably emotional all this, Madam Chair, but hopefully we can arrive and cooler heads can prevail in ongoing discussion of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Welcome, Mr. Lake. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Lake, representing the State Bar Association. In the spirit of ongoing discussion, I had a brief chance to talk to Representative Lesh about this yesterday. As of right now, the bar doesn't have an official position on this bill. We are studying it. I have heard a variety of concerns from practitioners in different areas. You know, I think there's been a good discussion about the family law issues, but I think, you know, it's important to note also that the divorce touches other areas of the law as well. I mean, it's, the marriage is not just affecting the two parties. The instant they're married, they get quite a few benefits and rights and responsibilities that come with marriage that affect other individuals, other entities, and all levels of government. So, you know, there's issues, I think, within the bill and the way it's drafted that would affect definitely tax issues, real estate issues, probate issues, and these things really need to be, I think, worked out and given some further thought. But we are looking forward to further discussions with Representative Lesh and the proponents of the bill this summer.
Thank you. Any questions for this testifier, Representative Smith?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lake, could you expound upon any of the issues that you've heard or discussions that you've had with the attorneys in the state bar that impact all the different areas of this idea?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think at the core of it, for a lot of the issues that have come up, is this whole idea of a certificate of marital termination, using the correct terminology, and I think the acceptability and enforceability of that, quite a few concerns around that. There are a lot of statutes, you know, like in the probate area, that require a divorce decree. You know, there's provisions also dealing with in the probate area with automatic revocations or the ability to override those. You know, in the real estate area, I think Mr. Ditburner mentioned, you know, the necessity to have you know, proper terminology and provisions in order to maintain marketable title on property. You know, and buyers, lenders, you know, really need this this kind of certainty that comes with the divorce decree. Also, I think in their situations in real estate conveyance, the parties could do it, you know, through deeds, but the trouble comes in when you know, a party doesn't follow through on a promise to deliver or record a deed. If it goes through the normal court process, the divorce decree itself can act as the conveyance. So there's definitely some real estate issues. And on the tax end of things, you know, there's a lot of IRS code requirements that require a divorce decree that we think would probably require congressional or at least Treasury Department action if this legislation were to become enacted, because there's a lot of divorce-related tax issues related to alimony, dependent deductions, you know, investment assets, retirement accounts. You know, you right now have to have a, you know, a quadro to divide those and protect yourself from tax liability. So those are just kind of an overview of some of the things that I've heard.
Representative Smith, any follow-ups?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this testifier? Thank you, Mr. Lake. Ms. Hugdahl, you're next. And then on deck is Catherine Mullen.
Madam Chair, while Ms. Hugdahl is coming up, I know that there are ongoing, as Mr. Lay correctly pointed out, issues with the changing nature of dissolutions. For example, in using, if a couple's agree to both contribute 50%, only one person can get a tax deduction for example, dependent care costs. And that's federal. You can't do much about that under the tax code. And the tax code itself retains more vestiges of, you know, 1970s and 80s divorce law. So even under the current system, there are problems related to that. And if we were to go to this model too, those problems wouldn't disappear. They'd still need to be worked on at the federal level.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Ms. Hugdahl, go ahead and state your name and continue on with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. I just really wanted to talk about an issue that I think is an unintended consequence, and I think it's important for everybody to understand why I say the word unintended, because I think it is. I've talked to Representative Lesh, and I've spoken to the proponents of the bill, and it's about when you remove the oversight, there's some groups of cases that we have some concerns about, and I don't think that this is the intent that that Representative Lesh or the proponents have. And those are cases where we have situations of domestic violence or people with limited capacity. And currently when those cases come forward, even if they're agreements, when they come through the court process, a lot of times courts see things in those proposed decrees, even if there are agreements, that kind of are red flags to them. And they look at them and say, you know, there might be something more here. Maybe those are cases that get pulled in for a hearing. It's not common for a victim of violence to affirmatively step forward and say, hey, I'm going to kind of declare that there's an issue, especially if they're being pressured by the person who's abusing them, especially in cases also of people with diminished capacities. We see that too sometimes in cases of people with long-term illnesses. So I really want to be clear here that I'm not suggesting that the issue that I'm talking about is something that the proponents were thinking of as an outcome of this bill. So I think when you remove the court oversight from that process and you have this door available to people without any check, it does open the door for this to be used by people who want to take advantage of someone, who want to coerce someone into an agreement. And again, I don't think that's the intent of the proponents or the bill author. Unfortunately, that is part of the attraction, so to speak, for someone who of not having that oversight, is they can file this agreement, no one ever sees it, the court never sees it, and it's by state law equal to a court order and decree and judgment. So we're very concerned, and I appreciate that. I know the proponents have put language in here saying if you feel pressured or intimidated on page 5 to seek advice. I respectfully submit that in our experience with victims, that does not deter cases where someone is a victim being taken advantage of. So that the protections we're very concerned about in those cases. Again, I'm not suggesting that that's an outcome that was intended here, but I think it's a really serious issue when you take away the role of the courts in looking at these to see some of those issues that are out there. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this testifier? Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. Ms. Mullen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent, and continue on with your testimony, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Molin. I am the Policy and Outreach Coordinator for the Minnesota Catholic Conference. I'm here today to speak in opposition to HF 1348. The Catholic Church recognizes marriage as a foundational building block of society. While marriage has a private dimension, it entails the very public commitments that can produce both individual and community benefits. Marriage creates rights and obligations between couples for both spouses and any children that the marriage might produce. Marriage publicly obligates fathers to recognize any children that will come from the union and gives society the ability to publicly support unions where a couple will take care of those children. And though not every marriage produces children, every child has a mother and a father. In short, marriage is where people find stability and are cared for, as well as where the next generation is created and nurtured. When this union breaks apart, there are very important public concerns that must be addressed, and the state has an interest in overseeing this process. HF 1348 makes sense only under a very different conception of marriage, one in which marriage can be entered into and exited easily because it is simply a contract between two consenting parties. When their commitment ends, so does the marriage. However, this view of marriage as a contract between consenting parties fails to recognize that when a marriage breaks apart, the community also has an important stake in the outcome. It is the state that has to pick up the pieces of this broken relationship. Children and property are involved and have to be distributed. Society has an interest that this is done fairly and equitably, often because divorces occur with the initiative of one party and there is deep acrimony between the two partners. Further, a broken marriage could entail public support for one or both of the parties, and the wounds inflicted on children, which could reverberate throughout their lives and have an effect on those around them, needs to be minimized, which is why we impose the best interest of the child standard in custody cases. This significant lack of judicial oversight detracts from the task of family law to publicly protect all parties in marriage and its dissolution. For example, as other advocates have noted, privatizing divorce could allow one spouse to coerce the other into inequitable property distributions or create parentage agreements that do not serve in the best interests of the children. Often broken relationships are marked by abuse of one form or another, and such abuse could be used as leverage by the other spouse to coerce a result not in the public's interest. In these cases, it is important for judges to hear the facts, behaviors, and the circumstances of the marriage in order to ensure, to the greatest extent possible, that both persons are adequately represented and that any children born of the union are taken care of both financially and emotionally. Nearly every family in America has been touched by divorce. Even families who have not experienced separation or divorce have friends, neighbors, and other family members who have faced it. The Catholic Church understands the pain of those for whom divorce seemed the only recourse and walks with those who have been abandoned or mistreated, always trying to bind the wounds of the broken relationship. We recognize the good intentions of those who want to minimize the pain of broken relationships, but despite those best intentions, privatizing divorce does not solve, nor will it ease, the pain that these people and these families are feeling. As for the reasons noted, it has the potential in the long run to make those situations and their long-term impact on children and communities worse. As some legal experts have noted, this bill looks like a solution that's in search of a problem, as there are processes already in place to resolve disputes and fallouts related to broken marriages. One might claim that the church is defending an outdated view of marriage and that this legislation merely recognizes the transition of marriage into a means of formalizing the romantic arrangements of adults. Children are no longer being inherently connected to marriage in their creation or their nurturing. And indeed, cultural norms and legal rules, such as the redefinition of marriage, point in this direction. But we must ask ourselves, is that all that marriage is? Simply a contract formalizing the love and commitment of adults? Or, even though the legal definition of marriage has changed, is it still a public institution ordered towards the common good, where all of us have a stake in the outcome? If it is the latter, then this legislation is not a good way of protecting the public's interest in marriage. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Are there any questions for this testifier?
I've got a question, Madam Chair.
Representative Lush.
Thank you. Ms. Mullen, does the Archdiocese still offer to recognize annulments if the parties pay the Archdiocese for the petition and go through the process?
Ms. Mullen?
I'm sorry, you asked if the Archdiocese recognizes annulments or?
Offers annulments and recognizes them.
Ms. Mullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lush. The Archdiocese does recognize annulments when they go through the annulment process. If you have further questions about the annulment process, that would be something to be referred to the Archdiocese.
No, thank you. I think that's enough of an answer.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Before I have, actually I should ask if there's anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on behalf of this bill for or against. Please come forward and state your name for the record and go on to the testimony. We do have about 7 minutes left. Thank you.
My name is Susan Carpenter, and I can come to you to testify today from a professional and as a parent who went through a lengthy divorce process in our court system. I am a mediator and a conflict coach now because I learned so much from my own situation that I wanted to help other people try to avoid that. My family, and I also want to speak a little bit to domestic abuse because my marriage was a very abusive marriage, and I was married to an alcoholic. And so a lot of people who speak to domestic violence, they don't, they're book smart, but they're not life smart on it. One of the things that helped me move out of that situation was empowering myself for my own family. After having my rights as a parent taken over by other people who thought they knew better. And that was one of the biggest resentments for me, is that I was a parent. My oldest was 7 years old. No one had any problems with me as a parent. And my husband and I, with our difficulties, parented. Both of us were parents. And there were no problems with that until we entered the court system, and suddenly we were both terrible parents, and other people knew better than we did. But what I will tell you is that when the decision to divorce came, we went through, you know, a difficult time. We were both not on the same page about that. But when we did work through that, we got on the same page. We sat down at our kitchen table. We had someone watch the kids so we could do this together, cooperatively, discuss what we thought needed to be discussed. And now coming to this from the point of someone who didn't, I did not get married planning I'm going to get divorced. That was not ever something I was hoping to achieve in my life or knew anything about because I didn't believe in that. But here we were. I was with someone who no longer wanted to be married. So could I fight that or do I realize that I guess this is what we need to do? And I went through a lot of process to get to that point. Once we were in agreement that yes, divorce would be to the benefit of all of our family, we sat down, we worked out the really hard issues, and we had agreements on custody, child support, parenting time, the house, our debts, many, many things. But we weren't thinking about the law because we weren't, you know, this was not a planned thing. I didn't think, oh my God, I better read the statutes to see what my rights are. I sat down thinking, what is the best for my children? And people who work these things out are thinking about, if you ask people, what are you most concerned about, parents anyway, they will tell you the biggest answer you're going to get is, I just want my kids to be okay. So why do we think that parents who are divorcing cannot speak for their children or think about the best interests of their children? We don't treat other parents in the world this way. It's only in divorce. For people who weren't married, society says, go ahead, you know, decide for your children. It's only when they can't come into agreement that then they go to court, and the court then looks at both sides. I will tell you that we ended up getting all these court solutions for our problems, and it turned into a nightmare for all of us, my children. We still all have far-reaching effects from that. And I took drastic measures to get us out of the court system. I actually did a custody trial, which I had to fight to get because the courts don't want to do those. But it was so chaotic in our lives and so disrupted. Both of our hands were tied as parents. Neither one of us was really parenting our children anymore. The children were suffering from that. And I asked all over the legal community, what do I do to stop this? How do I make it better? And was told, the only real way is custody and you're never going to get it. Well, I'll tell you that I went and sought custody and I did get it. After which, we basically threw out all the court orders and parenting time was very flexible. We handled financial disputes realistically. You know, you go to court and it's all good on paper, but the truth of the matter is there's often a lot of little details down there that the court doesn't care about. And so I think when you empower people, you are making a difference. And I just want to say that this isn't just about the parents, the two people getting divorced. I think that if we give some families an option to go in and do this in a cooperative way, their children learn these tools as well. When the parents learn these tools, they use that then in their life going forward. And I see it all the time in the work I do. And this is, your children learn from your model. So if you go in and say, we're just going to fight everything out in court, that's what children think. That's what they think. Now I have a dispute with someone, got to go fight in court. Or they learn that fighting is normal, so they end up in relationships in their future in these contested, you know, volatile relationships where they could learn better things going forward, better ways to do things. So I think we can set an example for future generations. And I also think that it would help the court if some of these cases where people can manage this on their own are outside of the court. The court can then focus on these very complex or very contentious cases and give them the right kind of attention, And that doesn't always happen now. There's just not enough time for these court calendars to service everybody in the right way. And just one other thing I want to point out is that we have, I look at this as being a kind of a restorative process for families, a way to look at divorce as it doesn't have to be a fight, it doesn't have to be a war. It can be, you know, redefining your role in your family and your life going forward. And once people realize going forward their life's going to be okay, they do so much better, and they stop fighting typically. But I think this would give people a chance to kind of restore the family after this transition. And we offer some restorative systems already in other areas of law, like for juvenile petty crimes. We offer a juvenile diversion program, which is outside of the court system. Judges oversee it just to make sure that the juvenile followed that process, but they don't know what the juvenile agreed to do to make amends or anything like that. And we'll do that for an instance of crime, but people seem to think we can't do that for families, and I just don't think that's true. I think we can make things better for families. I don't think every family belongs in court. Family issues, hopefully we're not all suing everybody in our lives that we have disputes about, you know, our Aunt Edna or, you know, Cousin Jim or somebody, you know. So I just think some of the concerns are unwarranted. And I've seen people, another thing I've seen too is for families, I've done some mediations with people who are supposedly co-parenting, which is the best for the children, but they haven't spoken in 5 years. And to give people a chance to speak about what they need going forward, they may not get it, but it's having that discussion. You don't get that in the court. You're not empowered in the court. I was never allowed to speak to the judge until I had a custody trial. You know, someone else always spoke for me. Someone else always wrote the papers. And it wasn't really my words, and it wasn't really my ex-husband's words. We're not great friends now, but we can talk about the kids. Things were very cooperative once the court was gone. So I do feel strongly that some families would be best served not having to go to court if they don't wish to.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. I really appreciate your testimony and coming from your personal experience and now experience in the courts or in mediation and those sorts of processes. And, you know, first of all, any questions for this testifier? I know we're over time here, folks. Just some parting words, and then I'll let Representative Lesh have the last word. I do not like divorce. It's destroys people, destroys families. And that said, I am not opposed to divorce without courts. I'm not saying I'm for this bill. I have seen too many times the adversarial process add gasoline to the flames. And I've seen it on both sides of my family, the siblings on both sides, my husband's side and my own side. And anything that we can do to make the process less adversarial, I'm for. However, I do not want divorce to be fast and easy. The one thing that I do appreciate about this is that there is a 90-day waiting period. And if you interview people after decades after a divorce or even 5 to 10 years after a divorce, a lot of them will say, I wish I would have tried harder to save my marriage. And I think a waiting period of some kind is a really, really good idea. I would obviously, you know, want exceptions for domestic abuse. And as Ms. Hugdahl said, people with diminished capacities are not going to be able to possibly handle this on their own. So I'm very conflicted by this bill as it is written. But those are just my few comments, and with that, I'll let Representative Lesh have the last word.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, despite those reservations, really I do appreciate you hearing this. You know, I would like to address what was brought up
with respect to domestic violence. Members, I've prosecuted domestic violence cases for 14 years now in the city of St. Paul. And I've seen my share of ugliness and sadness. And there's no question that that has gone on for a long time. This bill would not change that. That kind of stuff has gone on when we had fault-based divorce. It went on when we had no-fault divorce. Happens under the current system. It'll happen if we pass this bill. It'll happen if government decides to get out of the business of recognizing marriages and leaving it to the churches, as the subject came up during the marriage debate 2 years ago. But this bill is not going to change that. What's going to change that is a sea change in our attitudes about domestic violence. And in any situation, there's the potential for one person to have the upper hand. And in those cases, absolutely, a court-based divorce is appropriate. But just because those situations exist is not a reason to remove the opportunity for peace and harmony for others who want a divorce that is better for their family. And I would close with this, Madam Chair. And I can't get over Mr. Dittmurner's characterization of a judge as a sheepdog. Members, that is a phrase that story about there's wolves and there's sheep and there's sheepdogs, and the sheepdogs are there to protect the sheep from the wolves, and some people are just plain sheep. Some people are the wolves because they're the bad guys, and then there's the sheepdogs. Members, that floats around in the warrior community among folks who are infantry and combat arms because they like to fancy themselves a sheepdog. It feels better to call yourself a sheepdog. I'm out there to protect the sheep. A judge is not a sheepdog. A sheepdog is a warrior. The defining characteristic of a warrior is to close with the enemy and do violence in order to achieve justice. It is telling that someone would characterize divorce as war because they see the divorce process as something as ugly and as adversarial as war, and that's how it's going to be. But it's not even the judge's job to be a sheepdog. It's their job to resolve disputes. And if that's the lens through which you look at people's dissolutions, then those dissolutions will permanently be rife with horrible situations. So I hope we can have a continuing conversation about this. I will add this too, that I got a lot of comments from family law attorneys who don't like the bill. And on the first bill today, Mr. Dittmurner came up and talked about the conventions he had with judges and family law attorneys on your bill, Madam Chair, and said no one agrees with this. We universally think it's a bad idea. Not once was brought up the people who have to live with it afterwards, the people who are affected by these decisions. And similarly with this, I'm sure there are folks in the industry who disagree with it, because it's a change. It could potentially affect income, but it's a change, and change is difficult. But it's our job to think about what's important, not just for lawyers and judges, but for the people that have to live with the consequences of divorce afterwards. And I think this is a good option for them. So again, thank you, Madam Chair, for giving this opportunity.
And Representative Les, just one analogy that you made that I wanted to just let you go on the record to clear up, hopefully, was that you made the analogy of getting out of your rental lease as being able to handle that on your own. Why can't you handle, you know, the divorce on your own versus going through the courts? And I just hope that you weren't in any way paralleling getting out of a lease with getting out of a, quote-unquote, getting out of a marriage. And I don't see those two as, there's no comparison.
There's no questioning, Madam Chair, that ending a marriage is a far, far bigger deal than ending a lease. There's no question about it.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess I should maybe stop at that. Yes.
Wanted to make that. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.